Hey, this is Pam. And I'm hanging out at the Illinois Railway Museum in Union, Illinois. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Pam. Enjoy the Railway Museum. Good people out there in Union, Illinois. And we'll be talking about some rail issues on the show today. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's Almost Above Ground Audio Magazine. I am Mike Steven. Welcome to the program. This is show number 812. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Say hello online, all the social media outlets, and download the podcast of this program for free. You can also subscribe for free or check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com or WGNRadio.com to get the audio archives of the show. Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN Radio studios today. Good morning to Ferg. And speaking of those audio archives, lots of audio gold in the audio archives of Outside the Loop for this show. And this week, friend of this show, Nick Kindlesberger of the Chicago Tribune, put out a list of some of the best taco spots in Chicago. If you have listened to the show or you know me, you know that I love tacos and I'm always on the lookout for great taco places. Nick is a font of knowledge. He compiled this list and it reminded me that six years ago, I sat down with Nick Kindlesberger at a taqueria, La Lagartija, in Chicago, and we talked about why tacos are so great. This is what Nick had to say.
Well, we're really lucky. We have a lot of Mexican immigrants in Chicago and in the Chicago region, millions of them, which gives our scene just a whole a depth to it that a lot of big towns don't have.
If you look for the smaller places, the smaller taquerias, I mean, that's where you're getting the authentic flavor. And it all comes back to why do we love this food so much? I think it's simple, but it's powerful. It's flavorful. It's filling. And it's you don't have to do a whole lot to it, although there is a lot that goes into a taco. It's very deceptive.
That's a good way to put it. I mean, what gets it for me is the salsa is a and that combination with tortillas and meat is what really sets it apart. And the first time I had real Mexican food with chilies and lime juice and cilantro, I never looked back. I didn't know why I wasn't eating this all the time, and so I've been trying to rectify that situation for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that clip from Outside the Loop, show number 504, almost exactly 6 years ago. Nick has been doing this work. He writes about other food items as well. But tacos, that's where it's at. We all know this. So Nick, you're a special person. Keep doing what you're doing. And you, the listener, are a special person. Have a taco. Put some salsa on there. This is a spicy show. Illinois is seeing some federal money for infrastructure projects, including rebuilding rail bridges. Streets Blog Chicago is a website that covers issues of local sustainable transportation, and according to one recent post, quote, Metra and the Union Pacific Railroad, which owns the Union Pacific North Line, are currently developing a plan to replace bridges, shore up embankments, and improve viaducts between Fullerton and Addison. But the most contentious aspect of the project is the Metra and UP plan to shift the railroad tracks west, closer to local homes, end quote. Igor Studenkov is the reporter who wrote this piece. And as he talks about, there is some controversy here and some tensions that have boiled up recently. Igor joins us here on Outside the Loop today. Igor, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this. First of all, this plan, right, of what's going on here, this project. So like I said, this is part of a bigger project, and this is sort of natural when, you know, railway embankments get old and the rail lines get old. So this is just basically the sort of natural upkeep that Metra and the Union Pacific are doing, right?
In short, yeah, part of it is that the maintenance and a lot of those bridges and the embankments has been deferred and deferred. So it's kind of catching up to them. So
yeah, and so now we have to replace those or make some repairs. And so here's the issue. So we've got Metra moving some tracks, as they are known to do, right in that area. Again, we're talking like the Lincoln Park, Lakeview area. And what this means is that trains will be basically closer to the homes that are near these tracks. Is that kind of at the core of what the controversy is here?
Yeah, that is definitely a big part of it. Another part of this is that over the years, some of the homeowners over there put up community gardens on the embankment because there are some homes which immediately abut the embankment. And this wasn't an issue when all the space was unused, but as they're shifting tracks west, a lot of those gardens are going to have to go. And then another related issue is a lot of the trees that have grown on the embankment over the years will have to go.
Right. And so what's basically happening here is the homes that are near these rail lines, and there are some homes that are part of a kind of a gated community, they've been using that embankment essentially as a backyard with, you know, their trees back there, and maybe they use some green space for gardening, but they've basically been treating that as a backyard. And with this plan, that green space is basically going away.
Correct.
Interesting here, because what happened at a meeting recently with Metra and some residents, there was a little bit of controversy here. Residents were demanding a town hall, and you were there. Tell us what went down at this meeting.
All right. So the meeting was set up in the open house format with had a whole bunch of display boards, and people could walk from station to station, talk to employees. And at around 6:30 points, a lot of them neighbors started gathering in one of the rooms and started talking about how they make a stand and demand a town hall where, you know, everybody would gather, sit down and ask questions to all of the assembled project staff. And now I didn't think anything of it because in all of my years of covering public transit, you know, this would not be the first time there were dissatisfied people.
Sure.
And but then, you know, folks gathered, I would say, around 30 to 40 people, and basically said that they weren't going to move until there's going to be a town hall. But then, you know, the police left, the officials left, and a few minutes later, I start hearing that Metro agreed to do a town hall in the other room. And, yeah. and sure enough, like around 20 minutes later, 6:50, they rounded up some chairs for people gathered, and they did a town hall. I've never seen anything like this at any meeting ever.
So they forced a town hall, talking to the Metro officials, the residents who live next to this project, this rail project. So this land, technically, that we're talking about here isn't owned by the residents. This is not their land, but they're basically demanding that this project take a different direction. What exactly are their arguments here?
Well, the argument is basically they're fine replacing bridges, they're fine replacing the railroad tracks, but they want to keep the railroad tracks where they are, even if it's more expensive, even if it requires taking the tracks out of service, because the reason why Metro is planning it the way it is to make sure that at any given time there are two tracks in service. Mm-hmm. And basically, like I said, at any given time, there are two tracks running both directions. But you know, if you can't do that, if you can't have an extra track, that means there's going to be one track. That means that Metro is going to have to slow down service. And Metro's contention, that's one part of it. And another part of it is that they want to have the bridges prefabricated on site and replaced, which is also going to drive up costs and also going to cause logistical difficulties because this is a residential neighborhood.
You know, I'm thinking about this and just devil's advocate here. I mean, when the folks who live there bought these properties, they knew that this land was not their land behind where they live, this area of the embankment and the tracks. And this could have been a possibility. So what are they saying? I mean, what do they want to see here? Because on one hand, okay, this could cause an inconvenience. You're moving the trains closer to their homes. But on the other hand, you kind of knew that this was always a possibility in the future. What are they saying here in terms of what they want?
They insist that there's got to be a way to avoid moving the tracks west. And they're basically saying that, you know, if Metro would just talk to us, if Metro would just listen, then we could figure out a way to make this work.
Yeah, I mean, is there any idea or any plan for a possible compromise? Is that even on the table, or is this project pretty much going ahead full steam?
I mean, part of the issue, this is something that's going to have to be decided by the Metro Board of Directors. As the Metro officials at the meeting kept pointing out, their middle management, they can't really make this kind of decision, but it would require changing the scope of the project. And because another part of it is they did look at it, you know, the possibility of keeping tracks where they are, and they eliminated it because it would be more expensive, because it would mean they would have to slow down service, and they did rule it out. I mean, on one hand, never say never. On the other hand, you are asking Metro to take the more expensive option, the more disruptive option, disruptive for the riders, I should say. And they're going to have to come up with the money for that somewhere.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens here. But this is kind of just a snapshot of what's happening. We got on one hand, hey, great, projects that are happening, that's awesome. We are rebuilding and refreshing our infrastructure, but sometimes that comes at a cost, and sometimes that's happening quite literally in our own backyard. Check out chi.streetsblog.org to see what Igor Studenkov and his colleagues are writing over at Streets Blog Chicago, covering issues of local sustainable transportation. Igor, thank you so much for talking to us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Well, it looks like next week we could be turning a corner when it comes to the weather. Let's hope. So that's a good thing, especially because on Saturday, May 14th, that's next Saturday, in Grant Park, Girls on the Run Chicago will host its 5K for the first time since 2019 in person. This organization is a youth development program that inspires girls in third through eighth grade to recognize their potential. Jill Eade is the executive director of Girls on the Run Chicago, and you can check out gotrchicago.org, and she is back here on Outside the Loop. Jill, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
You are welcome. And so you've been on the show before, and we've talked about Girls on the Run Chicago before and all the great work that you do. And I said that this is a youth development program, and you're focusing on working with girls in third through eighth grade. Tell us exactly what it is you do, some of the programs that you offer for these girls.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mike. You know, at the core of our program, we really celebrate girls' individual superpowers and give them a safe space to discover their own unique abilities. And that's really, I think, beautiful and powerful. But where the rubber here meets the road is really in the programming. And so we use a research-based curriculum where over the course of 8 to 10 weeks, girls are taken through our curriculum where they are really building critical life skills. So things like managing conflict, setting healthy boundaries, navigating emotions, you know, things we as adults could honestly quite often use.
And sure,
they are really building up the mental, physical, and emotional stamina to take on our celebratory 5K event, which is happening next Saturday. So we use running as a tool in which to teach these critical life skills.
Right. So your organization is called Girls on the Run Chicago. And yeah, running is definitely, it's definitely a part of what you do. But you're talking about, like you're saying here, building these life skills. And I think the necessity for that, and we've talked about this before, how it speaks to where our society is. We've made progress for sure when it comes to recognizing, you know, some of the issues that women are facing and certainly young girls are facing. But I think that we need to keep that spotlight there because whether or not we realize it, society is sort of, you know, teaching us what it means to be male or female. And that really starts at an early age. And so you're targeting this early age to try to empower these girls because we've seen that sometimes our society doesn't do that.
Yeah, we are really, you know, we are focused on serving third through eighth grade girls because that's really the period of time in life where they are absorbing all of the messages that their community and society is telling them about how they should be and, you know, how they should act. And so we really see ourselves as coming in at a critical life point or transition point and really helping to harness girls' existing confidence and really make sure it doesn't drop. So research shows that girls are most confident between the ages of 8 and 9, and then that confidence tends to plummet and doesn't really come back up to meet their male peers until they're in their 60s, right? And women are a different part of life. And so we really know that that confidence exists within them, and we're really just creating that safe space to allow for them to live into it and lean into it and not lose it.
And these programs that you spoke about before, that's what you're focusing on, building confidence. And again, you know, maybe, look, I've never had to think about that as a male, but this is something that affects so many women, and whether or not they know it. I think that's kind of the crazy thing here, right, is that sometimes we might not even know that this is going on, but as you're talking about here, studies have been done in terms of confidence. And there is this age where girls hit and all of a sudden their confidence plummets and it doesn't come back up until much later in life.
Yeah. And we hear, I was recently talking to some alumni this week, and it's so interesting because they often say, you know, I ask them, like, what is the thing that you carry with you from your Girls on the Run experience? And these are women that are in the workforce, right? 20s, 30s. Mm-hmm. And both of them separately, totally different conversations, said confidence. I really built my confidence during my years with Girls on the Run. And I think that's just so important and so critical that we are helping to support that through our programming.
Well, tell us about what's going on in Grant Park next Saturday, May 14th. Girls on the Run Chicago will be having its first in-person 5K since 2019. This is cool. This is like a culmination of the program, right?
Yes, this is what the girls... So we really think about our program is an opportunity to build intentional goal setting. So girls are working to build up, again, this physical stamina, emotional stamina, and mental stamina to take on a 5K event. And I think the important difference about our event is that it's non-competitive. So we teach our girls that it's about a growth mindset. It's not about a performance mindset. We don't care who comes in first place. That doesn't matter to us. We really care, are you improving against yourself week over week? And so really we see this as a moment of that capstone celebration, and we'll gather with more than 2,000 of our girls.
Wow.
Who will take on this race with hundreds of volunteers and spectators and adults running alongside them. So we really can't wait to host this amazing event next week.
So it's next week. That's Saturday, May 14th in Grant Park, downtown Chicago. We can go to the website, gotrchicago.org, gotrchicago.org. And that's how we can, if we're interested, register, volunteer, all at that website, right?
Yes. And we are still in need of volunteers. So it is not too late to join us. We would love to see you there. And that finish line, man, that Girls on the Run finish line is the most magical and beautiful place. When you see girls crossing that line, it is like the full range of human emotion, right? Girls are thrilled and proud and excited and triumphant, but they're also exhausted and there's some tears. And when I look at that finish line, it is girls of every shape, size, color, you name it. And I always think to myself, the future is safe because these girls are coming. And so it is powerful and it is incredible. So we hope to see you there.
Check out the website, GOTRChicago.org. The 5K in person for the first time since 2019 in Grant Park next Saturday, May 14th. It's going to be great, and the programming that you do with Girls on the Run Chicago is wonderful and necessary. Unfortunately, it's necessary, right? But I'm happy that your organization exists, Jill. Again, check out GOTRChicago.org. Jill Eade is the executive director of Girls on the Run Chicago. Jill, thank you for talking to us again. Good luck with this event, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Yes, connecting across town once again to the lair of an apartment of Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. The Reader, Steve, that will continue on as a nonprofit. We should mention that. That's cool.
That's some of the better news. You know, we were saying some things this year weren't so great, maybe a few minutes ago off the air. maybe, possibly.
Yeah.
That is one of the better things, and my editor of since 2004, Mr. Philip Montoro, who helped sort of lead the fight on that, is a very, very happy man. And seeing him happy is great. Seeing Reader people happy, knowing that the Reader is going to continue, and that the people who had the problem with it, the partial owners, have stepped down and let it become a nonprofit so that it can continue and perhaps even thrive. Great news.
Excellent news. So we will celebrate that. I love it.
Who doesn't love good news in this day and age?
That's right. Oh, boy, I'll take it. And, hey, what better music to celebrate to than some, like, soulful, jazzy tunes? That's what we're hearing today from the band Three Souls. The band is Three Souls. Is that accurate to say soulful jazz? Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, they're a cool sort of group because, you know, they towed the line, I think, you know, between some genres, and all the guys, if you, you know, you sort of look at them even individually, played with blues artists and jazz artists, and I guess a good term, you know, which I had not heard before and was sort of my almost my preface at the beginning of this week, is tavern jazz.
Tavern jazz. What does that mean?
Well, you know, see, I hadn't heard this, and my friend John Corbett, who is a sort of, you know, as I said, a sort of Svengali of jazz in particular, and all sorts of music here in Chicago. Many years, he runs a gallery. He has done so many things. I used to go to his jazz nights at Empty Bottle years ago in ye old 90s when I first moved here, and it was a real education, you know, for me. On local and international people would play and stuff. So anyways, yeah, you know, when I had like a little Secret History offshoot TV show, and I sort of had guests on who came on and played records, and John pulled out this record, and immediately I was like, okay, this is an extremely local thing, and I never had seen it before. And this is, you know, I like, because the album is called The Dangerous Dan Express. And that is a very local reference, and it was pictures of said express.
Yes, the Dan Ryan.
Yes. And, you know, again, not something a lot of people would get probably outside of the city. And I was like, whoa, what is this? And then, you know, he sort of explained it, put it in context and said they were, you know, sort of because he's a bit of a historian and no, a true historian, and sort of put it in context of, yeah, you know, they were just like, there's sort of gritty, hardworking band that sort of did this very, you know, they had to be sort of versatile and play for different kinds of audiences. But, you know, they mostly excelled at playing in sort of like sweaty clubs, you know, getting them on record was sort of like almost secondary and, you know, sort of a miracle sometimes in a way too, you know, but, yeah, so yeah, yeah, he kind of called it, you know, the epitome of the tavern jazz. I hope I have that right. And I was, I think, you know, cause we were in this moment, you know, and, yeah, it was really great to, you know, get a lesson like right there, you know, mm-hmm. and sort of put it in context of the city of Chicago as well. You know, and I think most of this was probably on the South Side and the West Side and stuff, but actually their home base was out of Old Town. It sounds like they had a residency there. So it's, you know, I love the sort of, you know, historical, sociological context of these things as well, I have to admit, as well as the music. You hear it and you're like, this kicks ass, you know.
Right,
well,
right,
you're like, these guys are slamming, this must have been amazing live. You're the organ player's like Jimmy Smith on that, you know, the drummer's funky. It's not necessarily the kind of thing, you know, like intellectuals necessarily stroke their beards to per se, but it's still beloved by like DJs today to play. They'll get a dance floor moving, you know.
No, for sure. And I think that's one of the, I don't know, stereotypes for good or bad about jazz. It's that it's this highfalutin sort of intellectual above everyone else experience. And there's plenty of examples of jazz just, you know, rocking and getting in that funky groove. And let's talk about this band again, Three Souls. Really, you're focusing the story here on Landon Sonny Cox, born in Cincinnati, Ohio, around 1938, we think, but that seems to be, and he's playing saxophone eventually, but boy, you hear that sax. I mean, that's really a key part of this band.
He wouldn't divulge his age. He was a real character. Okay. Let's just start off here and say, we won't spoil it for anyone
right
at the end, but he was a character, and I had no idea. This was me educating myself. I did not know what he had, like, basically two careers and was a real character, you know, embellished a bit, I think, on some things. And so it was, there's a lot of disclaimers in this strip because they're like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. He claims he moved here in this year. Wait, no, no, no. He would have been way too young, you know? So there's some things that don't make sense in his timeline a little bit. So, you know, he was a good, like, hype man for himself, no matter what he did, I think, you know?
Which is good. I mean, you need that. So Sonny Cox here. And again, you know, you said you're not going to spoil it, but maybe some of us have heard of this guy because he does get fairly famous, not necessarily for music, although he is a slamming sax player. But we'll talk about maybe briefly what happens later on. So he, from Cincinnati, originally drafted by the Reds, by the Cincinnati Reds out of Kentucky State University, and he plays for the minor league team, but a bad knee ends his career. So he goes then whole hog to music, but I mean, what a crazy beginning.
Yeah, and he's still playing like three sports in college. He still played, you know. He just, I think, couldn't, you know, necessarily play in the major or minor leagues, you know, per se, you know. But yeah, yeah. So he was, he always sort of had a concurrent career. But then, yeah, he started, you know, this sort of a testament to his versatility is he starts off backing, you know, mostly sort of like R&B soul artists like Jackie Wilson, Solomon Burke, Jerry Butler, you know, huge for Chicago soul, and
sure,
had a second career himself, Mr. Butler, in politics. So, you know, an interesting beginnings for sure.
He takes up residence on the South Side. According to what you're saying here, he's nicknamed Sonny Cox, because folks thought he sounded like Sonny Stitt, another famous saxophonist, and they actually played together.
When Sonny Stitt came to Chicago, he got to play with him since he had the rep of being a Sonny, I guess, you
That's
know,
crazy.
Or whatever. So, you know, we've talked about some cats who came to Chicago and had misfortune. You know, it seems like he was generally doing pretty well. And they, his group, the Three Souls, got signed seemingly pretty quickly, too.
Yeah, so the Three Souls come about in the early 1960s, and they have a contract with Chess. It's Chess Records, right? Or a subsidiary of Chess.
Yeah, it's a little Argo, which will go on to be Cadet Records, which you see a lot more of around because Cadet was a little bit later 60s. So those records are, yeah, they're definitely all around Chicago. But it was a really good stable of artists. And yeah, he just met the other guys in the band seemingly just kind of out in the scene, the drummer, Robert Shy or whatever. So yeah, at first it was called the Three Souls. And then later on, he definitely became the focus, and it was like Sonny Cox and the Three Souls, which is, I guess, what they tried to sign them as. And maybe he fought it at the beginning, but he couldn't. He was so clearly the front man, I guess, you know, of that band or whatever. But yeah, you know, like I said, a sort of a gritty, earthy, kind of groovy jazz that, you know, funny enough, their records are probably most championed still by, again, this sort of UK Northern Soul scene, which there's a certain kind of tempo groove that they love to dance to over there. And it crosses over into soul and R&B and stuff as well. It's just like a certain tempo and stuff. So I believe they seem to be pretty known on that sort of that circuit.
Let's talk about what happens here. So this band is, you know, the 60s are pretty much the heyday for Three Souls. And what happens here? I know you said you don't want to spoil things, but maybe we can allude to what happens to Sonny Cox, because I don't know if it comes out of left field. Oh, there's a little sports tie in there. but maybe, you know, we don't see it coming like it does.
Yeah, so, you know, it seems like his music career, you know, sort of fizzled just a little bit. I mean, everyone went on to, like, play with cool people, you know, and Cox did one album on that Cadet label, which was Argo in 66, and it's cool, and Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire Future is playing on it. Great production and all that, but he really didn't do too much after that. Robert Shy went on to play with Von Freeman and all these people. So I guess a friend of his got a job teaching, and he was like, I guess they asked him, do you got a degree to teach or whatever? And I don't know if he did, but he decided, okay, I'll do this for money. I can like play jazz at night. I can supplement my income, kind of teach during the day. Mm-hmm. And then that starts turning into coaching jobs. And, you know, obviously he had this, you know, early proclivity for sports or whatever too. So it seemed like that really fit him like a glove, you know, and he according to who you talked to, was one of these inspirational coaches who produced insanely great athletes, or a guy who was a little bit uncompromising / crooked in his dealings and ethics. And yes, he made the news for it when he went to the college level. He had some winning teams, but he was controversial.
Yes. Okay. So Sonny Cox ends up coaching basketball locally, but some controversy there. That'll be the tease to get everyone to read the ending of your strip.
You can read about his time at King College Prep High School. And then some of the things that, you know, possibly the greatest high school basketball coach in the state of Illinois, he was called at one point. His record is crazy, no matter how you want to slice it. And that he went from, you know, a pretty, had a bit of fame – sax player to a pretty famous coach is that was a new one on me.
Sonny Cox passes away May 5th of 2020. But what an incredible story. Great musician. And from what we're hearing here, a great coach. So we'll leave it up to you to decide. But you can check out the Secret History of Chicago music strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip, and he hand draws the musician or the artist that he's profiling. So you can see that as well in the strip and online. Steve, as always, sir, I thank you for your insight, and put me in, coach. I'm ready to play some saxophone.
Groove on.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 812 is donezo. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I appreciate it as always. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer in the studio today. I'll talk to you again next time. Have a fantastic week. And thanks again for listening to Outside the Loop.